After an unconscionably shaky beginning, the Church of God Awaiting had actually gotten most of it right when it came to building its navy. Not all of it. That would have been expecting far too much out of a land animal. But once Elaine Maguire had actually stopped to think, once Jaspar Clinton had pointed out that the galleys he was building were exactly the wrong ships, the church's captain general had put a great deal of effort into recovering from his initial errors. He'd shown a surprising degree of insight in the process, and he'd found quite a few capable men, like Cornelis Harper, to help him do it. There were still blind spots. His insistence on eschewing the shorter-ranged carronade, for example. He hadn't picked up on the huge advantage the Carisian ship's coppered bottoms gave them either, and his galleons still boasted the forecastle and aftercastles of pre-Merlin Safehold, although they had been reduced in height. Taken all together, though, he'd actually done almost as well as the Earl of Thirsk when it came to visualizing the threat and how to build a ship that could meet it. And while the Temple Guard had no real naval tradition, it did understand discipline and the value of rigorous training. Unlike certain secular powers, the Guard had no institutional objection to finding experts who could teach it what it didn't know either. Bad weather, ice, inefficient foundries, Carisian raids on essential shipping, all of them had helped to delay the church's great project, but they hadn't been able to stop it, and men like Arnald Tybald and Cornelis Harper knew what to do with those ships once they were built. Yet, for all that, there were still weaknesses. For all their own courage, all the effort they'd spent on forethought and planning, it would never have occurred to Harper or Tybald to attack a numerically superior enemy under the cover of a tropical front's waterfalls of rain. And for all the millions upon millions of marks the church had invested in its fleet, it hadn't realized the importance of light units. It saw the fleet, graceful Carisian schooners as corsairs, as commerce raiders, without really appreciating their value as scouts, as swift bloodhounds to scent out an enemy fleet, or as the exquisitely sensitive whiskers of a cat lizard to sense an approaching enemy before he could reach striking range. And because of that, Admiral General Harper had snugged his columns of galleons down for the night without pickets to guard his flanks, reducing canvas to minimize the risk of collisions and avoid the possibility of damage if it turned out there were squalls hidden within the rain after all. To keep his fleet from scattering, and to be sure it would be the efficient, compact, concentrated force he and Tybald had made of it when the sun rose and the rain ceased. Which was why not a single lookout in a single ship of the Navy of God had seen a thing as 25 Carisian galleons came ghosting out of the dark. Brian Lock Island stood quietly, hands clasped behind him. The rain was easing, although it still came down in sheets. That was fine with him, and so was the fact that there was actually going to be quite a lengthy break between this band of rain and the next one, coming up from astern. "Just last long enough for us to get in amongst them before you clear," he thought at the weather. "Just last long enough." He'd made only a single minor course change since they'd turned in to attack. He could feel Captain Baker's tension, although the captain hid it well, but Lock Island himself was surprised to discover he was almost as calm as he looked. Unlike his flag captain, he knew they were on precisely the correct heading. On the other side of the rain, lashing the surface of the sea to a white froth ahead of them, there was an enemy fleet, and HMS Armagh and her sisters were stealing up upon the outermost column of that fleet like assassins. He felt muscles and sinews tightening, not with fear, but with anticipation, and had to bite his tongue to keep from shouting for his gunners to stand to.
"Not yet, not yet, Brian. Wouldn't do for the lookouts to be wondering how you saw the other side clear from the quarter-deck before they did. All sorts of unwelcome little questions could come out of that. And then,
"Sail 2 points abaft the larboard bow, sir."
The forward lookout had kept his wits about himself and passed the word aft, relayed from man to man, rather than raising a shout.
"Good,"
Lock Island said, as an electric shock ran through the men on the quarterdeck about him. He sensed them stirring, back straightening, eyes narrowing, as they realized he had indeed found the enemy for them. He felt himself leaning forward, squinting, as if he could somehow physically see through the rain and the darkness, and then his eyes widened. The rain was beginning to taper off, and he discovered he could see a long, slowly moving column, 14 high-sided galleons, poop lanterns gleaming, light showing through skylights or, here and there, through gun ports opened for ventilation. Those lights picked them out of the night, illuminated his targets, while his own lean, black-painted ships came slinking out of the shadows.
"We'll cross their sterns, Captain Baker," High Admiral Lock Island said formally. "Then we'll come to larboard, take the wind on the beam, and pound them from leeward while we overhaul. Keep an eye out for their second column, though. We don't want some bright bastard over there to get any ideas about working up to windward."
"Yes, sir."
The rearmost ship in Cornelis Harper's windward column was the 50-gun galleon NGS St. Ithman. Her ship's company had done well in the fleet's endless sail and gunnery drills. Over the thousands of miles they'd voyaged, hard work, training, and growing experience had transformed them from a crew only too conscious of its own lack of experience into one confident that it no longer had anything of which to be ashamed, and there was a great deal of truth to that. But training or no training, growing experience or no experience, no one aboard St. Ithman expected an attack any more than Harper or Tybalt had. Her lookouts had been more concerned with keeping track of consorts who represented potential collision hazards and with finding ways to shelter from the downpour than with the ridiculous possibility that the Imperial Carisian Navy might choose a night blacker than the Pit of Shan Wei to assail them. And so no one was looking in the right direction when HMS Armok came sliding out of the dark like the Archangel of Death himself.